Council, our next case for the day is appeal number 10-3597, River Road Partners against Amalgamated Bank. And we'll hear first from Mr. Neff for the debtors after everybody has changed positions there.
May it please the Court. My name is David Neff, and I'm here on behalf of the debtors' appellants. This matter is before the Court on a direct appeal from an order of the Bankruptcy Court that denied bid procedures motions in two cases, one involving the Intercontinental Chicago O'Hare, the other involving the Radisson LAX. The bid procedures motions proposed to sell the hotels free and clear of the lender's liens in connection with Section 1129B2A3 of the Bankruptcy Code, which allows a debtor or a plan proponent to provide for the indubitable equivalent of a secured creditor's claim if the secured creditor votes against the plan that's proposed. Now, at the outset, I would note that the appeal is not moot. The debtors never abandoned their plan sales. In fact, we filed new asset purchase agreements that contain the same exact term that Judge Black found objectionable, namely prohibiting the lenders from credit bidding.
What's the current state of the deal?
Again, there are two separate
stalking
cases.
Your stalking horse buyers.
The stalking horse buyers have signed new asset purchase agreements.
For how much?
I believe with regard to the Intercontinental Chicago O'Hare, it's approximately $57 million. And with regard to the Radisson LAX, I believe it's around $47.5 million. So they're at higher prices.
47, you say?
47.5. So they're at higher prices than the original asset purchase agreements.
And how much is owed on each of those, if you know, from the credit, the creditor?
I believe they're in excess of $120 million on each. Yes. So the appeal will have a direct impact, obviously, on whether we can proceed with our plan. So we believe that that mootness is not an issue. The sole issue on appeal, we believe, is resolved by a straightforward reading of the statute. Section 1129B2A, as I mentioned, is basically the cram-down section for secured creditor claims. We believe it is clear and unambiguous on its face. It provides three alternate paths to satisfy the fair and equitable treatment for secured creditor. First, plan can provide that the creditor retains its lien against the collateral and receives deferred cash payments equal to the present fair market value of the property. That's our traditional reorganization, internal reorganization plan. Secondly, the plan can provide that the secured creditor receives the proceeds from the sale, and at the sale, the secured creditor has the right to credit bid unless that right is otherwise denied for cause under Section 363, as provided for in Section 363K of the Bankruptcy Code. Then there's a third alternate path, which is where the secured creditor receives the indubitable equivalent of its claim. Now, each of these sections, between the second and the third, is the word or. Or is even defined in the Bankruptcy Code in Section 102.2 as being not exclusive.
Mr. Neff, let me move ahead a little bit if I could. Why doesn't your reading of the statute make essentially superfluous subsection 2 on sales free and clear of liens where creditors can put in credit bids? Why would any debtor use that method?
I could give you an example straight from our case, in fact. At the Intercon Chicago O'Hare, there are two outparcels which have a separate debt, albeit it's cross-collateralized. They are not essential to the operation of the hotel. We could propose to sell those and allow the lender to credit bid because they're not essential to the ongoing operation. They could be.
You could, but why would you do that if you had the alternative of getting cash for the bankruptcy estate?
Well, you would propose to allow credit bidding in several. For instance, if you had a situation where you believed that you were going to ultimately get from the proceeds of sale in excess of what the secured creditor is owed.
Well, then you wouldn't care. Right, then you're indifferent, right?
Well, you're trying to maximize the proceeds of the estate while at the same time confirming a plan.
Well, okay, let me narrow the question. You're talking about a situation in which the secured creditor is not even undersecured. I'm talking about an undersecured creditor, which is where you've got a problem. Why would any debtor, under your theory, use subsection 2?
If you had multiple parcels of property and you didn't, one parcel of property, you didn't necessarily need the cash from it, it was simply your way of disposing of that particular asset.
No. Okay. You're saying there's not enough money to care about, but I'm saying let's take each of those parcels. You can either have an auction with credit bids that will generate no cash, assuming that you're undersecured, or you can have an auction without credit bids that will generate cash for the bankruptcy estate. You'll always be better off. The bankruptcy estate, forget the secured creditor, but the bankruptcy estate will always be better off with that cash, right? What am I missing?
It depends how much cash you need.
Well, I thought the theory of bankruptcy law and most law is that some cash is better than no cash.
It is, but you need sufficient cash to confirm a plan. And beyond that, if you have a situation, for instance, with our outparcels, we don't need the cash generated from there. We would like to maximize what we receive from them, but whether we get $7 million or $8 million or the lender credits its debt, we're agnostic to that.
You talk about the outparcels, did you say?
They're two restaurant parcels that have separate mortgages.
They may sell for fair market value.
Well,
we're talking about where you've got a less than half of your bids from the stalking horse. It's less than half of what is owed.
Correct.
Just in obvious being owed. The outlier, probably if you separate it out and it's a restaurant or something, you're going to get independent people to buy that. Not very many people are going to bid in to buy a whatever it is, $1 million hotel. So you've got a limited number, and your stalking horses are the only two. The only two that are available, and they're willing to pay less than half of what's owed.
That is as the initial stalking horse, correct. We obviously hope to generate substantially in excess of that at an actual auction. And the reason we're seeking to preclude credit bidding, in part, is to generate more spirited bidding. And, in fact, it is a requirement of the stalking horse that we preclude credit bidding.
But you also
credit bidding will tend to maximize the return to the estate, will it not? Isn't that the whole point of having a sale?
It won't necessarily maximize it if the lender is making a bid that is not an economic bid. In other words, if he's making a bid that's so high simply to recoup the collateral. Now, you could look at it and say, well, but that's maximizing the return to the estate because if he wants to bid in excess of fair market value, then it means his deficiency claim is less. The problem is it's not generating any cash that can be used to implement the plan. And Section 1123...
Well, it does maximize the return, doesn't it?
Well, it's a hollow victory because you can't confirm a plan if you have no cash.
Well, right now it's operating... Both hotels are operating now, right?
That's correct.
And the cash that's generated, with theoretically, is belongs to the creditor, is being used to keep the hotel going, right?
That is correct.
So, so far they're ongoing, and the outside bidder is sort of, the longer it goes, the better off they are.
It could be. It could be a situation. Also, you'd have a situation where the asset is appreciating enough during the course of a bankruptcy that you can ultimately,
which apparently it is,
file a confirmable plan.
Based on what you're saying, things are getting better and maybe occupancy is better.
There's no question that it is, and the lenders have stipulated twice in the case that they've been adequately protected. And so
adequately protected how?
Oh, as far as the value of the property is not decreasing. The value of their collateral has not decreased since the petition date.
Okay.
But by going to III or whatever it is, the creditor is just out of the picture. He's on the sidelines. He just has to wait until it gets down to whatever this indubitable equivalent is, and then that's up to the bankruptcy judge. And in the Fifth Circuit, they got down to that because it had already occurred. And they looked at it and said, well, he got what had coming, and they settled and whatever, so they didn't need to go any further.
Right.
But we're not there.
We're not there at this stage, and if Your Honor would, if this court affirms, we will never get there. And in fact, you won't get there in many cases, because early on in cases where there's this large discrepancy between what the collateral is worth and what the lender is owed, it will be impossible or near impossible for the debtor to keep the case going by arguing that at some point it can confirm a plan, because of the lender would be able to argue that it can simply credit in its debt at any sale.
But if it's going to be free and clear in liens, I thought that was pretty much confined to double I.
And well,
it seems to me that's they take the triple I and then reach up and grab the free of liens as well. So you're going to get the best of both worlds, I guess.
It's not really how the statute is written. And I think that's what caused the Third and Fifth Circuits.
Yeah, this is a 4I, I guess. Huh?
To go the other way, which was to look at this. And, in fact, there are other sections of the bankruptcy code where there is limitations placed on the options that you have. By use of various language, you know, except as set forth herein or in subsections 1 or 2. And it's actually interesting to look at the only other section in the bankruptcy code that discusses this indubitable equivalent test, which is section 361.
Incidentally, I think you're claiming that the term indubitable equivalent has a plain meaning. Is that right?
Well, yes, I believe that
if it's all that plain, why are we even having this debate? Because the lenders obviously don't think this is the indubitable equivalent.
Well, the lenders believe that if you are proceeding to do a plan sale, you have to proceed under subsection 2. And our point is that obviously there's the option to proceed under 3.
I'm distracting you from Judge Cuddy's question.
If you look at section 361, it talks about where secured parties entitled to adequate protection. And it's written a similar way. It says you can provide them cash payments, you can provide them with a replacement lien, or such other treatment as will allow them to realize the indubitable equivalent of their interest that needs to be adequately protected. And in there it specifically says, however, you cannot offer them an administrative claim. So specifically written in the statute, the limitation. There is no limitation here. If Congress wanted to limit all plan sales such that they must allow credit bidding, they could have easily done so. They could have put it either in subsection 3 of section 1129, A2B2A, or they could have put it in section 1123A5D, which is kind of the enabling clause that allows you to do plan sales. And they could have said right in there.
You're telling us we ought to examine the legislative history to determine the intent of Congress?
Well, we would suggest that the language is clear and that Your Honor does not need to go there because of the use of the word or. If you do go to legislative history,
we make a big deal out of or.
Yes, we do make a very big deal out of or. Legislative history is not particularly instructive. There's basically one comment.
Representative Edwards, who's got a pretty specific comment, right?
Well,
it's
he does
not
in connection
you,
with
but it's
in connection with 1111B, but it's not even an accurate comment. He says that you can't, you don't have the right to make a section 1111B election, which allows you to have your deficiency claim also treated as secured. In a plan sale, he tries to explain that because the lender has the right to credit bid, but it's not necessarily true. The lender does not have a right to credit bid if there is found to be cause, which to date most courts have found to be some sort of bad act by the lender or some sort of lien priority dispute.
You're anticipating one of the things I wanted to ask you. And for both sides here, we're not talking about absolutes, about rigid rules here, because you've got the good cause exception, even under the lender's theory. And even under your theory, the lenders have got the ability to say, wait a minute, the results of this were not the indubitable equivalent. My question on your side is, why isn't the good cause protection sufficient for protecting the interests of the bankruptcy estate?
Really two reasons. One is it has really not been interpreted that way to date by courts. They're looking
How
for
clear is it?
Well, my point is I can't, as a debtor's lawyer, it's difficult to go under cause and convince a bankruptcy judge that the chilling the bids is necessarily going to be cause when most of the case law to date is some sort of a lender bad act or a lien priority dispute. For instance, there's mechanics liens that may be ahead of it. But secondly, I have to prove up at an initial hearing before I ever get to a plan that credit bidding will chill bids. It's
credit bidding will what?
Credit bidding, if we allow the lender to credit bid, it's going to chill other bidders. That's a rather tall task to actually have evidence that you can bring in to get other prospective buyers to come into court to testify, if they're allowed to credit bid, then we're not going to be interested in doing all of the due diligence that we'd have to do in order to make a bid for the assets. So it's really the process is better played out to the plan confirmation to allow the whole bankruptcy process to see what additional consideration can be provided to the lender as far as indubitable equivalence. There may be resolutions reached that obviate the issues. Lenders may come in and bid cash at the sale. We're not preventing them from doing that.
I noticed there was some mention of, I guess, mechanics liens and others, that it may be the main creditor may be subordinate to those.
Correct.
What amount? Is there do you have sort of a ballpark figure of how much you're looking at there?
With regard to the Intercontinental O'Hare, it's about $9 million.
$9
million? Yes.
Okay. And I don't guess it doesn't matter, but it's a fair amount, though. It's not just
very substantial. And yeah. On the Radisson LAX, I think it's about $15 million.
Okay, so the credit bidder is subordinate to that.
That would be the debtor's argument. The debtor believes that, at least with regard to the Intercon, because the general contractor's contract predated the mortgage, that under Illinois law.
Well, whatever the law is, I mean, usually though they are ahead of the main lender.
Correct.
So this is going to be an additional amount that the credit bid is going to have to take into consideration when he walks in, if he's able to participate.
That's correct.
Before you're into your rebuttal time, but before you sit down, I'd like to ask a question so the defense also has a chance to respond to it. The amicus brief in this case argues at page 21 of their brief that the bankruptcy code, quote, carefully provides that a secured lender may always either keep its full lien or get all of its collateral. Is that true?
No.
Tell me why not.
Well, I could preclude credit bidding for cause, so they don't always get it back.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have the right.
Are there any other exceptions?
Well, you don't have the right to make a Section 1111B election, for instance, to have your entire claim treated as secured if the collateral is of inconsequential value. And that happens. I mean, not necessarily you have to have environmental contamination, which might do it, but a second lien lender.
Well, this is not inconsequential in this case.
It is not in this case, but it's not an absolute, as they phrased it in the amicus, is my point.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. For the appellees, Mr. Lewis.
Thank you, Your Honor. Adam Lewis of Morrison & Forster for Appellee Amalgamated Bank. Your Honors, the position of the debtors depends essentially on the contention that the plain meaning of the statute is in their favor. If you don't agree with that contention, there's nothing else, as I will explain shortly, to support the position the debtors take. Indeed, bankruptcy policy supports the opposite. There's no bankruptcy policy that the debtor's position assists, and all that happens is that a buyer, which often includes an insider, as was the case here, gets a windfall. And so you can see their position does not provide any benefit to the estate, to the creditors, or to the debtor, unless there is enough money, there's enough value in that property to exceed the amount of the lien that has to be paid, whether it's a cash bid or a credit bid.
Then we don't care, right? Then we don't care. The whole problem here is undersecured creditors, right?
Well, that's right. But my point is, until you get enough of a bid over the amount of the claim, there's no money for anybody else. It can't possibly benefit the debtor, and it can't possibly benefit the estate. Now, I'll come back to that later on. So let me go back to the plain meaning of the language argument. That argument depends on the notion that you can examine a piece of language always and decide just by looking at it all by itself in a statute that its meaning is plain. It's kind of like, I forget which justice it was who said he knows pornography when he sees it, but he can't define it. I'd like to draw an analogy here, Your Honors. First of all, the Supreme Court teaches us in a number of cases that we've cited and some that the amicus have cited that you do look around in a statutory scheme to see whether the language is plain. And indeed, the analogy I'd like to draw is with the parole evidence rule in California. I don't know how it works in Illinois, but in California, of course, the basic rule is you can't introduce parole to contradict the terms of an unambiguous statute contract. But you can introduce parole to guide the court into a determination of whether it is unambiguous. And so here, you look around, as the Supreme Court has told us, at various aspects of a statutory scheme or a statute to see whether, indeed, it is plain on its face. And if you do that here, you see that it's not. If the interpretation of the debtors of how A2 works is correct, then you have to ask yourself why Congress bothered putting in A2 at all, if it's basically subsumed. If the area of credit bidding is subsumed in A3 in part, why not entirely? To put it a little bit differently, if the statute meant what the debtors contend it mean, then the way the statute would have been structured, and structure is another thing the Supreme Court teaches us you look at, is you would have had an A1, which is the same as the A1 today, and an A2, which is the same as the A3 today. You'd have no A2 as it reads presently. Separately, you would simply have A3 saying the indubitable equivalent, including but not limited to, and there you would see the language that you see in A2. But you don't have that structure. You have Congress separately setting out the language in A2 as a separate choice. And you have to suppose Congress did that for a reason, because the Supreme Court also says you don't interpret statutes to have
superfluous.
Thank you. Meaning.
We do this more often than present. You do, perhaps. So.
It always happens. It's like the first scratch on your car. Sooner or later, it's going to happen. But that's what the debtors would have us do. And the debtors would have you apply the word or sort of slavishly. But if you look through the code, I know of at least one other instance where you can't do what they say or means. If you look at 1112B of the Bankruptcy Code, which governs conversion or dismissal of a case on motion of the court or another party, as contrasted with A, which governs conversion or dismissal by the debtor, it says in the introductory paragraph, the court can convert or dismiss. Well, it can't do both. So the word or there can't have the meaning in 102 that's ascribed to it, and that the debtor says you must apply throughout the bankruptcy code. Just doesn't work. And as Congress and as the Supreme Court has said, you look around to see whether an interpretation is consistent with the statutory scheme. So once you get past the plain meaning of the language theory, which I think you do easily here, then you ask yourself, how do we interpret this issue? And there you see that there is nothing that favors the debtor's interpretation. because, as I've begun to explain before, if you follow the debtor's interpretation, our case is a perfect example. They will sell this property, perhaps for something less than its real value, and certainly something less than its lien. And I would, just as an aside, Your Honor, while the debtors have filed new plans with higher prices are not only substantially below the claims, but they're below the values that the debtors' own experts and own testimony indicated they ascribed to the properties.
Are these appraisals that are submitted part of the record? Or
Your Honor, they're part of the motion to augment the record in connection with the mootness argument.
Looking at double I, you say too, I guess I should say too, we're talking about free and clear of such liens. They've incorporated that into 3 or 4, where we are. Are you saying that it's confined to 2? That's the section where it's free and clear of liens?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm saying that A2, or AII, is the only way that you can have a planned sale free and clear of liens.
And when it's free and clear of liens, what's the practical effect of
that? What happens is that the property is transferred to the buyer without the lien, so he doesn't have to take subject to it. He gets a clear title, and the proceeds are paid to the estate, and the estate and a replacement lien, the lien that was on the property, is then placed in the same priority on the proceeds.
A replacement lien, is it in a different amount?
No.
Same amount?
Same lien, just different collateral.
So they remain intact, and then it's attached in whatever.
That's right. That's exactly right.
I don't exactly understand that. But what happens to the creditor lien?
The creditor, it's as though the creditor, it's as though.
That's assuming a creditor bid, then, isn't it?
If the creditor credit
bids?
Two. If the creditor credit bids, then the lien disappears.
That lien does. I asked you earlier about the mechanics liens and others that they say is somewhere in 9.
Yeah, so
nine and 15 million, so right. It's fairly substantial.
You won't find credit bidding once the sale has been consummated and the cash is in the estate. There's nothing to credit bid for. You just have cash with liens on it. There may be a fight over priority, as there may be with respect to the mechanics liens or some of them, but you're not going to have a credit bid sale. Credit bidding is a concept that's used in connection with sales.
Right.
And that's what's so once the sale has occurred, you're not talking about credit bidding anymore. It's the cash that has the lien on it. And that's kind of the point here, in part. Once again, to come back to this point, there's no benefit to the estate as long as the bid does not exceed the amount of the lien, because all of that cash comes to the creditor. So he either gets it by credit bidding, where no cash runs to the estate, or he gets it if we're somehow denied the right to credit bid. He puts the money, if he decides to bid cash himself, he puts the money on the table with his right hand, and he takes it back off with his left hand. What's the point? Why run it through the estate sort of nominally like that? It doesn't benefit the creditors because there's no surplus for them. There's obviously no surplus for the equity, for the debtors. The only party that might benefit from this process is the stalking horse bidder or some other overbidder who bids, but bids below the amount of the lien.
Mr. Lewis, is there a concern in this field, particularly with these kind of single asset companies when they go into bankruptcy, that there's kind of a mutual back-scratching that can go on among stalking horse bidders and owners of other folks? I mean, in this case, as I understand it, the new bids have withdrawn the insider's 5% interest in the stalking horses. But I gather there's nothing that prevents handshakes or understandings among different developers. If you need a stalking horse bidder, I'll be it, and if I need one, you'll do it for me.
That's right. And, Your Honor,
Swap their hotels and leave the lenders out in the cold.
And it can affect how the marketing takes place for the auction itself. And so that's a different kind of problem that may come to the indubitable equivalent problem. But, yes, it plays there, too. Mm-hmm. So and clearly was in play here in this case, as far as I'm concerned, where you have a stalking horse bid that was dramatically below what even the debtors already knew was the value of the property.
In that kind of a situation, why isn't the statutory provision that allows the bankruptcy judge to say that the results are not the indubitable equivalent, sufficient protection for the lenders?
Your Honor, the first answer to that question is really two, I think. But the first answer to the question is that Congress has given secured creditors two methods that it considers adequate to protect themselves. One is the 1111B election where that applies, and the second is the right to credit bid. And Congress is not necessarily saying we're going to give to secured creditors every possible remedy that you could conceive of to protect them. But we are going to give them some protective remedies, and those protective remedies permeate this situation on a 363 sale and in plan confirmation. As we argue it, you either get the 1111B election or you get the right to credit bid to protect yourself against the debtor or some third party, frankly, getting the property at a below market value and getting the upside in that property that may already exist, because we know that valuation is an uncertain thing. Those of us who practice in bankruptcy court, we do those all the time. We have valuation hearings, we have experts, we have appraisers, they differ. And what part of what Congress is thinking is we're not going to put the risk of undervaluation on the secured creditor. It's not something he should have to suffer.
I think I'll ask this question of your opponent before I ask it of you, but since you're up there, I think their theory, in part at least, the argument in part at least, is based on the proposition that auctions that exclude credit bids always provide creditors with the indubitable equivalent of their claims. Is that the argument they're making, basically?
Well, I'm not sure.
What's your comment on that?
Well, I'm not sure it's the argument they're making. I think I kind of saw that somewhere in there. And the answer to that question is no. Because whether an auction provides the indubitable equivalent, you have to consider whether it provides market value. And the only way that you come to the conclusion that an auction without credit bidding invariably provides...
Well, that's what they're prescribing here, aren't they?
Yeah, and I think it's just wrong. For two reasons. First of all, an auction doesn't necessarily provide market value, whatever that might be. Depends on how it's compounded, how it's marketed, all kinds of things like that. And secondly, I disagree on another level, not really before the court today, but I might as well mention it. The assumption is that if something provides market value, it provides the indubitable equivalent. If you read In re Murrell, Leonard Tan's decision, which supplies that term, which was adopted in the code, if we're being denied the right to foreclose, we are entitled to compensation for that as well. If you read Murrell, what happens in Murrell is Judge Hand says, well, yeah, normally interest compensates you for the deferred payments you're going to get, but on top of that, you as a secured creditor face the risk that the debtor might not perform, and you fear that. And we're taking that your ability to protect yourself against that away from you, and we have to compensate you for that too. That was where there was no indubitable equivalent. And so
your position on this has got to be, it seems to me, whether you're undersecured or oversecured.
It may come to that. It hasn't yet. We haven't gotten to the indubitable equivalent issue yet, because I don't think they can even do this. Because this is not, perhaps your question assumes that A2 is simply a form of indubitable equivalence. That is, it
well,
could
I'm
have been.
I'm trying to figure out whether indubitable equivalent has a plain meaning.
I think, Your Honor, you would find that it doesn't, and that it will get, in every case where it's teed up, it will get litigated whether something satisfies the standard. So I don't think so. But I don't think we have to decide that to decide whether A2 is the sole method Congress has provided for...
No, but the courts that have gone against you have pretty much started with a proposition that this is a plain meaning problem.
They have. And as I argued here
if
at the outset...
That's right, then we've got problems.
And that's my point. But it was where I started here.
And in essence, you're asking us to send this issue to the Supreme Court.
Well, right? It depends
on... You're asking me to agree with you, we've got to create a circuit split. Hmm.
I'm not asking you to create a circuit split. I'm asking you, Your Honor, to affirm below. That may be the consequence. Mr. Neff can probably tell you that more than I. It will be in his hands if you affirm. That might well be the outcome, although it might be, again, moot by that time. We'll have to see by the time, if and when it gets there.
Early in this case, but...
We'll have to see, Your Honor. In the River Road case, we have our own plan on, and we're hoping to get the confirmation on that before too long. Don't know, but that's where we're hoping to be.
Let me ask you. Go ahead.
I just had one to focus on one thing. When you're looking at the underlying asset, these hotels, they're presently being run by the current management, and they're
yes.
operating on the cash that they are generating.
Our cash flow.
Your
yes.
cash, that's right. And so this is something you're not getting. Is there a threat there that these aren't going to be able to keep running, or something might happen by some kind of delay here, or are they sufficiently viable where they're going to, and apparently improving, that this present management, et cetera, is going to keep things relatively stable?
Well, you know.
So that whoever is bidding, and it, maybe there are others in the stalking horses, I don't know that. I don't know who bids $60 and $80 million for something.
Not me, Your Honor.
I don't think there are a lot of them around. So, and also whatever kind of risk there is in this kind of a business to take it over. So I'm just curious, as far as the underlying asset, is that reasonably stable at this point?
It seems that it is, Your Honor. But I don't think bankruptcy, if I can anticipate where I think you're going, I don't think bankruptcy is designed to ensure that a plan is confirmed sooner or later, come hell or high water. This case is almost 2 years old now.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
we've been denied
the ability to... The debtor is still in possession and operating it.
I'm sorry?
The debtor is still in possession
yes.
and operating it.
Yes. Yes, and we have a typically stipulated cash collateral orders. We've never had a contested one.
Mr. Lewis, let me ask you
yes.
Something that concerns me. I was asking opposing counsel about whether their theory makes subsection 2 superfluous, which was your point. But I also wanted to ask you, if the debtor chooses to proceed under subsection 1, that is with a sale where the lien carries forward, you're still left, if I understand it correctly, and it's not easy, frankly, for a non-specialist to understand, but you still only wind up with payments that have a current, that have a present value equal to the current market value of the collateral, right?
Well, the A1 sales transfer situation is not one that's used very often, and I don't think its contours are very clear. We've mm-hmm. actually thought about this a lot. It sort of depends in part on what the plan says. I mean, we're not quite sure, for example, who would be making the payments. Would it be the buyer who's taking subject to? But there's another way of looking at that section, which we think is actually the correct way, which doesn't involve that question. That subsection talks about a transfer, not a sale. And we therefore believe that the prohibition against the 1111B election in connection with a sale under a plan does not apply to A1 because A1 is not contemplating sales, it's contemplating other kinds of transfers, giving it to a subsidiary, giving it to an affiliate, something like that. Mm-hmm. And we'd still be able to make that election, which means that at the very least we'd have to get payments totaling the total amount of our claim. That's the way 1111...
On the face value, yeah.
Yeah. With a present value of the face value, but totally...
The present value, I thought, of the market value. Did I misread that?
Yeah, that's right. I'm sorry.
Totally, where you're undersecured. Hmm.
The payment stream has to total the total amount of the claim with a present value of the market value. That's correct. But that is protection against being a sold-out secured creditor.
And you keep your lien.
Yes.
So that if things appreciate... And the new payer gets into trouble, you might have some upside there.
Absolutely.
Be less undersecured.
There are okay. a variety of different schema I can think in terms of how payment works and when defaults occur.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Lewis.
Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Let's see. Mr. Neff, rebuttal. How much time? 2 minutes? Okay.
Just 3 points on rebuttal. Going back to the statutory language, Section 1129B2A, 1 and A2 are the means. 3 is the end, the indubitable equivalent. There is no dispute, I believe, but that I could offer, a debtor could offer substitute collateral to a secured creditor and proceed under subsection 3 as indubitable equivalent. If the lenders are correct, I really couldn't do that because invariably when I'm offering substitute collateral, I'm also going to pay them over time on that collateral. Well, subsection 1 says that if I'm going to be paying a creditor over time the present value of its secured claim, they have to keep their lien on the same collateral. So if the lenders are correct, then substitute collateral effectively is not a remedy to show indubitable equivalence under subsection 3.
What's an example of substitute collateral? Another hotel?
I'm going to give you a lien not on the Intercontinental Chicago O'Hare Hotel, but I'm going to give it on another parcel, another hotel that I own. And I would say that courts do allow substitute collateral, and that's why the reading is wrong. Benefit to the estate, there's a reason we're doing this. The stalking horse has proposed over future profits to make payments to unsecured creditors. There also is payment under the plan of mechanics lien holders, real estate taxes, various priority creditors, things that the lender would have to pay regardless. That's the reason that we're still doing this. And that's why the code builds in flexibility to allow a debtor to implement a plan. Lastly, I believe it's up to the best left to the bankruptcy court that views all the facts and circumstances of the case to determine whether there's any undue insider influence and whether the debtor is actually achieving market value or the indubitable equivalence. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Neff. The case will be taken under advisement.